Disc 4.
Meanwhile, my wife was visiting a divorce lawyer, a female one with a reputation of being a merciless ball squeezer. Claire was waiting for me when I arrived home at 6, rather early. The kitchen table was covered with notes and computer spreadsheets. A calculator sat ready. She was icy and well prepared. This time, I walked into the ambush. "I suggest we get a divorce on the grounds of irreconcilable differences," she began pleasantly. "We don't fight. We don't point fingers. We admit what we have been unable to say. The marriage is over." She stopped and waited for me to say something. I couldn't act surprised. Her mind was made up. What good would it do to object? I had to seem as cold-blooded as she. "Sure," I said, trying to be as nonchalant as possible. There was an element of relief in finally being honest, but it did bother me that she wanted the divorce more than I did. To keep the upper hand, she then mentioned her meeting with Jacqueline Hume, her new divorce lawyer, dropping the name as if it were a mortar round, then relaying for my benefit the self-serving opinions her mouthpiece had delivered. "Why did you hire a lawyer?" I asked, interrupting. "I want to make sure I'm protected." "And you think I would take advantage of you?" "You're a lawyer. I want a lawyer. It's that simple." "You could have saved a lot of money by not hiring her," I said, just trying to be a little contentious. After all, this was a divorce. "But I feel much better now that I have." She handed me Exhibit A, a worksheet of our assets and liabilities. Exhibit B was a proposed split of these. Not surprisingly, she intended to get the majority. We had cash of $12,000, and she wanted to use half of it to pay off the bank lien on her car. I would get $2,500 of the remainder. No mention of paying off the $16,000 owed on my Lexus. She wanted $40,000 of the $51,000 we had in mutual funds. I got to keep my 401k. "Not exactly an even split," I said. "It's not going to be equal," she said, with all the confidence of one who had just hired a pit bull. "Why not?" "Because I'm not the one going through a midlife crisis, so it's my fault." "We're not assigning fault, we're dividing the assets. For reasons known only to you, you've decided to take a cut in pay of $90,000 a year. Why should I suffer the consequences?" "My lawyer is confident she can convince a judge that your actions have wrecked us financially. You want to go crazy, fine, but don't expect me to starve." "Small chance of that." "I'm not going to bicker." "I wouldn't either if I were getting everything." I felt compelled to cause some measure of trouble. We couldn't scream and throw things. We damn sure weren't going to cry. We couldn't make nasty accusations about affairs or chemical addictions. What kind of divorce was this? A very sterile one. She ignored me and continued down her list of notes, one no doubt prepared by the mouthpiece. "The apartment lease is up June 30th, and I'll stay here until then. That's $10,000 in rent."
"When would you like me to leave?"
"As soon as you'd like."
"Fine."
If she wanted me out, I wasn't about to beg to stay. It was an exercise in one-upsmanship. Which side of the table could show more disdain than the other? I almost said something stupid, like, "You got someone else moving in?" I wanted to rattle her, to watch her do an instant thaw. Instead, I kept my cool. "I'll be gone by the weekend," I said. She had no response, but she didn't frown. "Why do you think you're entitled to 80% of the mutual funds?" I asked.
"I'm not getting 80%. I'll spend $10,000 in rent, another $3,000 in utilities, $2,000 to pay off our joint credit cards, and we'll owe about $6,000 in taxes incurred together. That's a total of $21,000.
Exhibit C was a thorough list of the personal property, beginning with the den and ending in the empty bedroom. Neither of us would dare fall into a squabble over pots and pans, so the division was quite amicable. "Take what you want," I said several times, especially when addressing items such as towels and bed linens. We traded a few things, doing it with finesse. My position on several assets was driven more by a reluctance to physically move them than by any pride of ownership. I wanted a television and some dishes.
Bachelorhood had been sprung suddenly upon me, and I had trouble contemplating the furnishing of a new place. She, on the other hand, had spent hours living in the future. But she was fair. We finished the drudgery of Exhibit C and declared ourselves to be equitably divided. We would sign a separation agreement, wait 6 months, then go to court together and legally dissolve our union. Neither of us wanted any post-game chat. I found my overcoat and went for a long walk through the streets of Georgetown, wondering how life had changed so dramatically. The erosion of the marriage had been slow but certain. The change in careers had hit like a bullet. Things were moving much too fast, but I was unable to stop them. Chapter 14. The sabbatical concept was killed in the executive committee. While no one was supposed to know what that group did in its private meetings, it was reported to me by a very somber Rudolph that a bad precedent could be set. With a firm so large, granting a year's leave to one associate might trigger all sorts of requests from other malcontents. There would be no safety net. The door would slam when I walked through it. "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" he asked, standing before my desk. There were two large storage boxes on the floor next to him. Polly was already packing my junk. "I'm sure," I said with a smile. "Don't worry about me." "I tried." "Thanks, Rudolph." He left, shaking his head. After Claire's blindside the night before, I had not been able to think about the sabbatical. More urgent thoughts cluttered my brain. I was about to be divorced and single and homeless myself. Suddenly I was concerned with a new apartment, not to mention a new job and office and career. I closed the door and scanned the real estate section of the classifieds. I would sell the car and get rid of the $480 a month payment. I'd buy a clunker, insure it heavily, and wait for it to disappear into the darkness of my new neighborhoods. If I wanted a decent apartment in the district, it became apparent that most of my new salary would go for rent. I left early for lunch and spent 2 hours racing around central Washington looking at lofts. The cheapest was a dump for $1,100 a month, much too much for a street lawyer. Another file awaited me upon my return from lunch, another plain manila legal-sized one with no writing on the outside of it. Same spot on my desk. Inside, two keys were taped to the left side. A typed note was stapled to the right. It read, "Top key is to chances door. Bottom key is to file drawer under window. Copy and return. Careful, chance is very suspicious. Lose the keys." Polly appeared instantly, as she so often did. No knock, not a sound, just a sudden ghost-like presence in the room. She was pouting and ignoring me. We'd been together for 4 years, and she claimed to be devastated by my departure. We weren't really that close. She'd be reassigned in days. She was a very nice person, but the least of my worries. I quickly closed the file, not knowing if she had seen it. I waited for a moment as she busied herself with my storage boxes. She didn't mention it, strong evidence that she was unaware of it. But since she saw everything in the hallway around my office, I couldn't imagine how Hector or anyone else could enter and leave without being seen. Barry Nuzzo, fellow hostage and friend, dropped by to have a serious talk. He shut the door and stepped around the boxes. I didn't want to discuss my leaving, so I told him about Claire. His wife and Claire were both from Providence, a fact that seemed oddly significant in Washington. We had socialized with them a few times over the years, but the group friendship had gone the way of the marriage. He was surprised, then saddened, then seemed to shake it off quite well. "You're having a bad month," he said. "I'm sorry." "It's been a long slide," I said. We talked about the old days, the guys who had come and gone. We had not bothered to replay the Mister affair over a beer, and that struck me as strange. Two friends face death together, walk away from it, then get too busy to help each other with the aftermath. We eventually got around to it. It was difficult to avoid with the storage boxes in the middle of the floor. I realized that the incident was the reason for our conversation. "I'm sorry I let you down," he said. "Come on, Barry." "No, really, I should have been here." "Why?" "Because it's obvious you've lost your mind," he said with a laugh. I tried to enjoy his humor. "Yeah, I'm a little crazy now, I guess, but I'll get over it." "No, seriously. I heard you were having trouble. I tried to find you last week, but you were gone. I was worried about you, but I've been in trial. You know, the usual." "I know. I really feel bad for not being here, Mike. I'm sorry." "Come on, stop it. We all got the hell scared out of us, but you could have been hit. He could have killed all of us, Barry. Real dynamite, a missed shot, boom. Let's not replay it. The last thing I saw as we were scrambling out the door was you, covered with blood, screaming. I thought you were hit. We got outside in a pile with people grabbing us, yelling, and I was waiting for the blast. I thought Mike's still in there, and he's hurt. We stopped by the elevators. Somebody cut the ropes from our wrists, and I glanced back just in time to see you as the cops grabbed you. I remember the blood, all that damned blood." I didn't say anything. He needed this. Somehow it would ease his mind. He could report to Rudolph and the others that he had at least tried to talk me out of it. All the way down, I kept asking, "Did Mike get hit? Did Mike get hit?" No one could answer. It seemed like an hour passed before they said you were okay. I was going to call you when I got home, but the kids wouldn't leave me alone. I should have. Forget it. I'm sorry, Mike. Please don't say that again. It's over, done with. We could have talked about it for days and nothing would have changed. When did you realize you were leaving? I had to think about this for a moment. The truthful answer was at the point Sunday when Bill yanked the sheets back and I saw my little pal Ontario finally at peace. It was then and there, at that moment, in the city morgue, that I became someone else. "Over the weekend," I said, with no further explanation. He didn't need one. He shook his head as if the storage boxes were primarily his fault. I decided to help him through it. "You couldn't have stopped me, Barry. No one could." Then he began nodding, in agreement, because he understood somehow. A gun in your face, the clock stops. Priorities emerge at once. God, family, friends. Money falls to the bottom. The firm and the career vanish as each awful second ticks by and you realize this could be the last day of your life. "How about you?" I asked. "How are you doing?" "The firm and the career stay on the bottom for a few short hours. We started a trial on Thursday. In fact, we were preparing for it when Mister interrupted us. We couldn't ask the judge for a continuance because the client had been waiting 4 years for a trial date. And we weren't injured, you know, not physically, anyway. So we kicked into high gear, started the trial, and never slowed down. The trial saved us." "Of course it did. Work is therapy, even salvation at Drake and Sweeney. I wanted to scream at him because 2 weeks ago I would have said the same thing." "Good," I said. "Oh, nice. So you're okay?" "Sure." He was a litigator, a macho player with Teflon skin. He also had 3 kids, so the luxury of a 30-something detour was out of the question. The clock suddenly called him. We shook hands, embraced, and made all the usual promises to keep in touch. I kept the door closed so I could stare at the file and decide what to do. Before long, I made a few assumptions. 1, the keys worked. 2, it was not a setup. I had no known enemies and I was leaving anyway. 3, the file was really in the office, in the drawer under the window. 4, it was possible to get it without being caught. 5, it could be copied in a short period of time. 6, it could then be returned as if nothing had happened. 7, and the biggest of all, it actually contained damning evidence. I wrote these down on a legal pad. Taking the file would be grounds for instant dismissal, but I didn't care about that. Same for getting caught in Chance's office with an unauthorized key. Copying it would be the challenge. Since no file at the firm was less than an inch thick, there would probably be 100 pages to Xerox, assuming I copied everything. I would have to stand in front of a machine for several minutes exposed. That would be too dangerous. Secretaries and clerks did the copying, not lawyers. The machines were high-tech, complicated, and no doubt just waiting to jam the instant I pushed a button. They were also coded. Buttons had to be pushed so that every copy could be billed to a client. And they were in open areas. I couldn't think of a single copier in a corner. Perhaps I could find one in another section of the firm, but my presence there would be suspicious. I would have to leave the building with it, and that would border on being a criminal act. I wouldn't steal the file, though. Just borrow it. At 4, I walked through the real estate section with my sleeves rolled up, holding a stack of files as if I had serious business there. Hector was not at his desk. Braden Chance was in his office with his door cracked, his bitchy voice on the phone. A secretary smiled at me as I strolled by. I saw no security cameras peeking down from above. Some floors had them, others didn't. Who'd want to breach security in real estate? I left at 5. I bought sandwiches at a deli and drove to my new office. My partners were still there, waiting. Sophia actually smiled as we shook hands, but only for an instant. "Welcome aboard," Abraham said gravely, as if I were climbing onto a sinking ship. Mordecai waved his arms at a small room next to his. "How about this?" he said. "Sweet E." "Beautiful," I said, stepping into my new office. It was about half the size of the one I'd just left. My desk at the firm wouldn't fit in it. There were 4 file cabinets on one wall, each a different color. The light was a bare bulb hanging from the ceiling. I didn't see a phone. "We'll get you a phone tomorrow," he said, pulling the shades down over a window AC unit. "This was last used by a young lawyer named Bainbridge." "What happened to him?" "Couldn't handle the money." It was getting dark, and Sophia seemed anxious to leave. Abraham retreated to his office. Mordecai and I ate dinner at his desk, the sandwiches I'd brought with bad coffee he'd brewed. The copier was a bulky one of 80s vintage, free of code panels and the other bells and whistles favored by my former firm. It sat in a corner of the main room, near one of the 4 desks covered with old files. "What time are you leaving tonight?" I asked Mordecai between bites. "I don't know. In an hour, I guess. Why?" "Just curious. I'm going back to Drake and Sweeney for a couple hours. Last-minute stuff they want me to finish. Then I'd like to bring a load of my office junk here tonight. Would that be possible?" He was chewing his food. He reached into a drawer, pulled out a ring with 3 keys on it, and tossed it to me. "Come and go as you please," he said. "Will it be safe?" "No. So be careful. Park right out there as close to the door as you can. Walk fast, then lock yourself in." He must have seen the fear in my eyes because he said, "Get used to it. Be smart." I walked fast and smart to my car at 6:30. The sidewalk was empty. No hoodlums, no gunfire, not a scratch on my Lexus. I felt proud as I unlocked it and drove away. Maybe I could survive on the streets. The drive back to Drake and Sweeney took 11 minutes. If it took 30 minutes to copy Chance's file, then it would be out of his office for about an hour, assuming all went well, and he would never know. I waited until 8, then walked casually down to real estate, my sleeves rolled up again as if I were hard at work. The hallways were deserted. I knocked on Chance's door. No answer. It was locked. I then checked every office, knocking softly at first, then harder, then turning the knob. About half were locked. Around each corner, I checked for security cameras. I looked in conference rooms and typing pools. Not a soul. The key to his door was just like mine, same color and size. It worked perfectly, and I was suddenly inside a dark office and faced with the decision of whether or not to turn on the lights. A person driving by couldn't tell which office was suddenly lit, and I doubted if anyone in the hallway could see a ray of light at the bottom of the door. Plus, it was very dark, and I didn't have a flashlight. I locked the door, turned on the lights, went straight to the file drawer under the window, and unlocked it with the second key. On my knees, I quietly pulled the drawer out. There were dozens of files, all relating to River Oaks, all arranged neatly according to some method. Chance and his secretary were well organized, a trait our firm cherished. A thick one was labeled River Oaks TAG Inc. I gently removed it and began to flip through it. I wanted to make sure it was the right file. A male voice yelled, "Hey!" in the hallway, and I jumped out of my skin. Another male voice answered from a few doors down, and the two struck up a conversation somewhere very near Chance's door. Basketball talk, bullets and nicks. With rubbery knees, I walked to the door. I turned off the lights, listening to their talk. Then I sat on Braden's fine leather sofa for 10 minutes. If I was seen leaving the office empty-handed, nothing would be done. Tomorrow was my last day anyway. Of course, I wouldn't have the file either. What if someone spotted me leaving with the file? If they confronted me, I would be dead. I pondered the situation furiously, getting caught in every scenario. "Be patient," I kept telling myself. "They'll go away." Basketball was followed by girls. Neither sounded married, probably a couple of clerks from Georgetown's law school working nights. Their voices soon faded. I locked the drawer in the dark and took the file. 5 minutes, 6, 7, 8. I quietly opened the door, slowly placed my head in the crack, and looked up and down the hall. No one. I scooted out, past Hector's desk, and headed for the reception area, walking briskly while trying to appear casual. "Hey!" someone yelled from behind. I turned a corner and glanced back just quickly enough to see a guy coming after me. The nearest door was to a small library. I ducked inside. Luckily, it was dark. I moved between tiers of books until I found another door on the other side. I opened it, and at the end of a short hallway, I saw an exit sign above a door. I ran through it. Figuring I could run faster down the stairs than up them, I bounded down, even though my office was 2 floors above. If by chance he recognized me, he might go there looking for me. I emerged on the ground floor, out of breath, without a coat, not wanting to be seen by anyone, especially the security person guarding the elevators to keep out any more street people. I went to a side exit, the same one Polly and I had used to avoid the reporters the night Mister got shot. It was freezing, and a light rain was falling as I ran to my car. The thoughts of a bungling first-time thief. It was a stupid thing to do, very stupid. Did I get caught? No one saw me leave Chance's office. No one knew I had a file that wasn't mine. I shouldn't have run. When he yelled, I should have stopped, chatted him up, acted as if everything were fine, and if he wanted to see the file, I'd rebuke him and send him away. He was probably just one of the lowly clerks I had heard earlier. But why had he yelled like that? If he didn't know me, why was he trying to stop me from the other end of the hallway? I drove onto Massachusetts in a hurry to get the copying done and somehow get the file back where it belonged. I had pulled all-nighters before, and if I had to wait until 3 a.m. to sneak back to Chance's office, then I would do so. I relaxed a little. The heater was blowing at full speed. There was no way to know that a drug bust had gone bad, a cop had been shot, a Jaguar owned by a dealer was speeding down 18th Street. I had the green light on New Hampshire, but the boys who shot the cop weren't concerned with the rules of the road. The Jaguar was a blur to my left, then the airbag exploded in my face. When I came to, the driver's door was pinching my left shoulder. Black faces were staring in at me through the shattered window. I heard sirens, then then drifted away again. A paramedic unlatched my seatbelt, and they pulled me over the console and through the passenger's door. "I don't see any blood," someone said. "Can you walk?" a paramedic asked. My shoulder and ribs were hurting. I tried to stand, but my legs wouldn't work. "I'm okay," I said, sitting on the edge of a stretcher. There was a racket behind me, but I couldn't turn around. They strapped me down, and as I entered the ambulance, I saw the Jaguar, upside down and surrounded by cops and medics. I kept saying, "I'm okay, I'm okay," as they checked my blood pressure. We were moving. The siren faded. They took me to the emergency room at George Washington University Medical Center. X-rays revealed no breaks of any type. I was bruised and in terrible pain. They filled me with painkillers and rolled me up to a private room. I awoke sometime in the night. Claire was sleeping in a chair next to my bed. Chapter 15. She left before dawn. A sweet note on the table told me that she had to make her rounds and that she would return mid-morning. She had talked to my doctors, and it was likely that I would not die. We seemed perfectly normal and happy, a cute couple devoted to each other. I drifted off wondering why exactly we were going through the process of a divorce. A nurse woke me at 7 and handed me the note. I read it again as she rattled on about the weather, sleet and snow, and took my blood pressure. I asked her for a newspaper. She brought it 30 minutes later with my cereal. The story was front page Metro. The narc was shot several times in a gun battle. His condition was critical. He'd killed one dealer. The second dealer was the Jaguar driver, who died at the scene of the crash, under circumstances still to be investigated. I was not mentioned, which was fine. Had I not been involved, the story would have been an everyday shootout between cops and crack dealers, ignored and unread by me. Welcome to the streets. I tried to convince myself it could have happened to any DC professional, but it was a hard sell. To be in that part of town after dark was to ask for trouble. My upper left arm was swollen and already turning blue. My left shoulder and collarbone were stiff and tender to the touch. My ribs were sore to the point of keeping me perfectly still. They hurt only when I breathed. I made it to the bathroom where I relieved myself and looked at my face. An airbag is a small bomb. The impact stuns the face and chest. But the damage was minimal. Slightly swollen nose and eyes, an upper lip that had a new shape. Nothing that wouldn't disappear over the weekend. The nurse was back with more pills. I made her identify each one, then I said no to the entire collection. They were for pain and stiffness, and I wanted a clear head. The doc popped in at 7:30 for a quick going over. With nothing broken or ripped, my hours as a patient were numbered. He suggested another round of X-rays to be safe. I tried to say no, but he had already discussed the matter with my wife. So I limped around my room for an eternity, testing my wounded body parts, watching the morning news babble, hoping no one I knew would suddenly enter and see me in my yellow paisley gown. Finding a wrecked car in the district is a baffling chore, especially when initiated so soon after the accident. I started with the phone book, my only source, and half the numbers in traffic went unanswered. The other half were answered with great indifference. It was early. The weather was bad. It was a Friday. Why get involved? Most wrecked cars were taken to a city lot on Rasco Road up in the northeast. I learned this from a secretary at the central precinct. She worked in animal control. I was dialing police extensions at random. Other cars were sometimes taken to other lots, and there was a good chance mine could still be attached to the wrecker. The wreckers were privately owned, she explained, and this had always caused trouble. She once worked in traffic, but hated it over there. I thought of Mordecai, my new source for all information related to the street. I waited until 9 to call him. I told him the story, assured him I was in great shape in spite of being in the hospital, and asked him if he knew how to find a wrecked car. He had some ideas. I called Polly with the same story. "You're not coming in?" she asked, her voice faltering. "I'm in the hospital, Polly. Are you listening to me?" There was hesitation on her end, confirming what I feared. I could envision a cake with a punch bowl next to it, probably in a conference room on the table with 50 people standing around it proposing toasts and making short speeches about how wonderful I was. I'd been to a couple of those parties myself. They were awful. I was determined to avoid my own send-off. "When are you getting out?" she asked. "Don't know, maybe tomorrow." It was a lie. I was leaving before noon, with or without my medical team's approval. More hesitation. The cake, the punch, the important speeches from busy people, maybe even a gift or two. How would she handle it? "I'm sorry," she said. "Me too. Is anybody looking for me?" "No, not yet." "Good. Please tell Rudolph about the accident, and I'll call him later. Gotta go. They want more tests." And so my once promising career at Drake and Sweeney sputtered to an end. I skipped my own retirement party. At the age of 32, I was freed from the shackles of corporate servitude and the money. I was left to follow my conscience. I would have felt great if not for the knife sticking through my ribs every time I moved. Claire arrived after 11. She huddled with my doctor in the hall. I could hear them out there speaking their language. They stepped into my room, jointly announced my release, and I changed into clean clothes she had brought from home. She drove me there, a short trip during which little was said. There was no chance at reconciliation. Why should a simple car wreck change anything? She was there as a friend and a doctor, not a wife. She fixed tomato soup and tucked me into the sofa. She lined up my pills on the kitchen counter, gave me my instructions, and left. I was still for 10 minutes, long enough to eat half the soup and a few of the saltines, then I was on the phone. Mordecai had found nothing. Working from the classifieds, I began calling realtors and apartment locating services. Then I called for a sedan from a car service. I took a long, hot shower to loosen my bruised body. My driver was Leon. I sat in the front with him, trying not to grimace and groan with each pothole he hit. I couldn't afford a nice apartment, but at the least I wanted one that was safe. Leon had some ideas. We stopped at a newsstand, and I picked up 2 free brochures on district real estate. In Leon's opinion, a good place to live right now, but this could change in 6 months, he warned me, was Adams Morgan, north of DuPont Circle. It was a well-known district, one I had been through many times, never with any desire to stop and browse. The streets were lined with turn-of-the-century row houses, all of which were still inhabited, which in D.C. meant a vibrant neighborhood. The bars and clubs were hot at the moment, according to Leon, and the best new restaurants were there. The seedy sections were just around the corner, and of course one had to be extremely careful. If important people like senators got themselves mugged on Capitol Hill, then no one was safe. Driving toward Adams Morgan, Leon was suddenly confronted with a pothole larger than his car. We bounced through it, getting airborne for what seemed to be 10 seconds, then landing very hard. I couldn't help but scream as the entire left side of my torso collapsed in pain. Leon was horrified. I had to tell him the truth, where I'd slept last night. He slowed down considerably and became my realtor. He helped me up the stairs at my first prospect, a run-down flat with the unmistakable smell of cat urine emanating from the carpet. In no uncertain terms, Leon told the landlord she should be ashamed showing the place in such condition. The second stop was a loft 5 floors above the street, and I almost didn't make it up the stairs. No elevator, and not much heating. Leon politely thanked the manager. The next loft was 4 floors up, but with a nice clean elevator. The row house was on Wyoming, a pretty shaded street just off Connecticut. The rent was $550 a month, and I had already said yes before I saw the place. I was sinking fast, thinking more and more about the pain pills I'd left on the counter and ready to rent anything. 3 tiny rooms in an attic with sloping ceilings, a bathroom with plumbing that seemed to be working, clean floors, and something of a view over the street.
"We'll take it," Leon said to the landlord.
I was leaning on a door facing, ready to collapse. In a small office in the basement, I hurriedly read the lease, signed it, and wrote a check for the deposit and first month's rent. I'd told Claire I'd be out by the weekend. I was determined to make it happen. If Leon was curious about my move from the swankiness of Georgetown to a three-room pigeonhole in Adams Morgan, he didn't ask. He was too much of a professional. He returned me to our apartment, and he waited in the car while I swallowed my pills and took a quick nap. A phone was ringing somewhere in the midst of my chemical-induced fog. I stumbled forth, found it, managed to say, "Hello." Rudolph said, "Thought you were in the hospital." I heard his voice and recognized it, but the fog was still clearing.
"I was," I said, thick-tongued.
"No, I'm not. What do you want?"
"We missed you this afternoon."
"Ah, yes, the punch and cake show."
"I didn't plan to be in a car wreck, Rudolph. Please forgive me."
"A lot of people wanted to say goodbye."
"They can drop me a line. Tell them to just fax it over."
"You feel lousy, don't you?"
"Yes, Rudolph, I feel like I've just been hit by a car."
"Are you on medication?"
"Why do you care?"
"Sorry. Look, Braden Chance was in my office an hour ago. He's quite anxious to see you. Odd, don't you think?"
The fog lifted, and my head was much clearer.
"See me about what?"
"He wouldn't say, but he's looking for you."
"Tell him I've left."
"I did. Sorry to bother you. Stop by if you get a minute. You still have friends here."
"Thanks, Rudolph." I stuffed the pills in my pockets. Leon was napping in the car. As we sped away, I called Mordecai. He'd found the accident report. It listed a Hundley Towing as the wrecker service. Hundley Towing used an answering machine for most of its calls. The streets were slick, lots of accidents, a busy time for people who owned tow trucks. A mechanic had finally answered the phone around 3, but proved to be completely useless. Leon found the Hundley place on Rhode Island near 7th. In better days, it had been a full-service gas station. Now it was a garage, towing service, used car lot, and U-Haul trailer rental. Every window was adorned with black bars. Leon maneuvered as close as possible to the front door. "Cover me," I said, as I got out and dashed inside. The door kicked back when I walked through, hitting me on my left arm. I doubled over in pain. A mechanic wearing overalls and grease rounded a corner and glared at me. I explained why I was there. He found a clipboard and studied papers stuck to it. In the rear, I could hear men talking and cursing. No doubt they were back there shooting dice, drinking whiskey, probably selling crack. "The police have it," he said, still looking at the papers. "Any idea why?"
"Not really. Was there a crime or something?"
"Yeah, but my car wasn't involved with the crime."
He gave me a blank look. He had his own problems.
"Any idea where it might be?" I asked, trying to be pleasant.
"When they impound them, they usually take them up to a lot up on Georgia, north of Howard."
"How many lots does the city have?"
He shrugged and began walking away.
"More than one,"
he said, and disappeared. I managed the door with care, then bolted for Leon's car. It was dark when we found the lot, half a city block lined with chain link and razor wire. Inside were hundreds of wrecked cars, arranged haphazardly, some stacked on top of others. Leon stood with me on the sidewalk, peering through the chain link.
"Over there," I said, pointing. The Lexus was parked near a shed, facing us.
The impact had demolished the left front. The fender was gone, the engine exposed and crushed.
"You're a very lucky man," Leon said.
Next to it was the Jaguar, its roof flattened, all windows missing. There was an office of some type in the shed, but it was closed and dark. The gates were locked with heavy chains. The razor wire glistened in the rain.
There were tough guys hanging around a corner not far away. I could feel them watching us.
"Let's get out of here," I said.
Leon drove me to National Airport, the only place I knew to rent a car.
The table was set. Carry-out Chinese was on the stove. Claire was waiting and worried to some degree, though it was impossible to tell how much. I told her I had to go rent a car, pursuant to instructions from my insurance company. She examined me like a good doctor and made me take a pill.
"I thought you were going to rest," she said.
"I tried. It didn't work.
I'm starving."
It would be our last meal together as husband and wife, ending the same way we'd begun, with something fast and prepared elsewhere.
"Do you know someone named Hector Palma?" she asked halfway through dinner.
I swallowed hard.
"Yes?"
"He called an hour ago. Said it was important that he talk to you. Who is he?"
"A paralegal with the firm. I was supposed to spend the morning with him going over one of my cases. He's in a tight spot."
"Must be. He wants to meet with you at 9 tonight at Nathan's on M."
"Why a bar?" I mused.
"He didn't say. Sounded suspicious."
My appetite vanished, but I kept eating to appear unmoved. Not that it was necessary, she couldn't have cared less. I walked to M Street in a light rain that was turning to sleet and in significant pain. Parking would have been impossible on Friday night, and I hoped to stretch my muscles some and clear my head. The meeting could be nothing but trouble, and I prepped for it as I walked. I thought of lies to cover my trail, and more lies to cover the first set. Now that I had stolen, the lying didn't seem like such a big deal. Hector might be working for the firm. There was a chance he could be wired. I would listen carefully and say little. Nathan's was only half full. I was 10 minutes early, but he was there, waiting for me in a small booth. As I approached, he suddenly jumped from his seat and thrust a hand at me.
"You must be Michael. I'm Hector Palma from real estate. Nice to meet you."
It was an assault, a burst of personality that put me on my heels. I shook hands, reeling, and said something like, "Nice to meet you." He pointed to the booth.
"Here, have a seat,"
he said, all warmth and smiles. I delicately bent and squeezed my way into the booth.
"What happened to your face?" he asked.
"I kissed an airbag."
"Yeah, I heard about the accident,"
he said quickly, very quickly.
"Are you okay? Any broken bones?"
"No," I said slowly, trying to read him.
"Heard the other guy got killed,"
he said a split second after I'd spoken. He was in charge of this conversation. I was supposed to follow along. "Yeah, some drug dealer."
"This city,"
he said as the waiter appeared.
"What do you have?"
Hector asked me. "Black coffee," I said. At that moment, as he pondered his choice of drinks, one of his feet began tapping me on the leg.
"What kind of beer do you have?"
he asked the waiter, a question they hated. The waiter looked straight ahead and began rattling off brands. The tapping brought our eyes together. His hands were together on the table. Using the waiter as a shield, he barely curled his right index finger and pointed to his chest.
"Molson,"
he announced suddenly, and the waiter left. He was wired, and they were watching. Wherever they were, they couldn't see through the waiter. Instinctively, I wanted to turn and examine the other people in the bar. But I withstood the temptation, thanks in no small part to a neck as pliable as a board. That explained the hearty hello, as if we'd never met. Hector had been grilled all day, and he was denying everything.
"I'm a paralegal in real estate," he explained. "You've met Braden Chance, one of our partners."
"Yes." Since my words were being recorded, I would offer little.
"I work primarily for him. You and I spoke briefly one day last week when you visited his office."
"If you say so, I don't remember seeing you." I caught a very faint smile, a relaxing around the eyes, nothing a surveillance camera could catch. Under the table, I tapped his leg with my foot. Hopefully we were dancing to the same tune.
"Look, the reason I asked you to meet me is because a file is missing from Braden's office."
"Am I the accused?"
"Well, no, But your possible suspect. It was the file you asked for when you sort of barged into his office last week.
Then I am being accused, I said hotly.
Not yet. Relax. The firm is doing a thorough investigation of the matter, and we are simply talking to everyone we can think of. Since I heard you ask Braden for the file, the firm instructed me to talk to you. Is that simple?
I don't know what you're talking about. It's that simple.
You know nothing about the file?
Of course not. Why would I take a file from a partner's office?
Would you take a polygraph?
Certainly, I said firmly, even indignantly. There was no way in hell I would take a polygraph.
Good. They're asking all of us to do it. Everybody remotely near the file.
The beer and coffee arrived, giving us a brief pause to evaluate and reposition. Hector had just told me he was in deep trouble. A polygraph would kill him.
Did you meet Michael Brock before he left the firm? Did you discuss the missing file? Did you give him copies of anything taken from the file? Did you assist him in obtaining the missing file, yes or no?
Hard questions with simple answers. There was no way he could lie and survive the test.
They're fingerprinting, too, he said.
He said this in a lower voice, not in an effort to avoid the hidden mic, but rather to soften the blow. It didn't work. The thought of leaving prints had never occurred to me, neither before the theft nor since.
Good for them, I said.
In fact, they lifted prints all afternoon. From the door, the light switch, the file cabinet. Lot of prints.
Hope they find their man.
It's really coincidental, you know. Braden had 100 active files in his office, and the only one missing is the one you were quite anxious to see.
Are you trying to say something?
I just said it. A real coincidence.
He was doing this for the benefit of our listeners.
I thought perhaps I should perform, too.
I don't like the way you said it, I practically yelled at him. If you want to accuse me of something, then go to the cops, get a warrant, and get me picked up. Otherwise, keep your stupid opinions to yourself.
The cops are already involved, he said very coolly, and my contrived temper melted. It's a theft.
Of course it's a theft. Go catch your thief and stop wasting your time with me.
He took a long drink.
Did someone give you a set of keys to Braden's office?
Of course not.
Well, they found this empty file on your desk with a note about two keys. One to the door, the other to a file cabinet.
I know nothing about it, I said as arrogantly as possible, while trying to remember the last place I'd put the empty file. My trail was widening. I'd been trained to think like a lawyer, not a criminal. Another long drink by Hector, another sip of coffee by me. Enough had been said. The messages had been delivered, one by the firm, the other by Hector himself. The firm wanted the file back, with its contents uncompromised. Hector wanted me to know that his involvement could cost him his job. It was up to me to save him. I could return the file, confess, promise to keep it sealed, and the firm would probably forgive me. There would be no harm. Protecting Hector's job could be a condition of the return.
Anything else? I asked, suddenly ready to leave.
Nothing. When can you do the polygraph?
I'll give you a call. I picked up my coat and left.
Chapter 16. For reasons that I would soon understand, Mordecai had an intense dislike for district cops, even though most were black. In his opinion, they were rough on the homeless, and that was the standard he invariably used to measure good and bad. But he knew a few. One was Sergeant Peeler, a man described by Mordecai as from the streets. Peeler worked with troubled kids in a community center near the legal clinic, and he and Mordecai belonged to the same church. Peeler had contacts and could pull enough strings to get me to my car. He walked into the clinic shortly after 9, Saturday morning. Mordecai and I were drinking coffee and trying to stay warm. Peeler didn't work Saturdays. I got the impression he would have rather stayed in bed. With Mordecai doing the driving and talking, and with me in the back, we rode through the slick streets into the northeast.
The snow they had forecast was, instead, a cold rain. Traffic was light. It was another raw February morning. Only the hardy ventured onto the sidewalks. We parked at the curb near the padlocked gates to the city lot just off Georgia Avenue. Peeler said, "Wait here." I could see the remains of my Lexus. He walked to the gates, pushed a button on a pole, and the door to the office shed opened. A small, thin, uniformed policeman with an umbrella came over, and he and Peeler exchanged a few words. Peeler returned to the car, slamming the door and shaking the water off his shoulders. "He's waiting for you," he said. I stepped into the rain, raised my umbrella, and walked quickly to the gate, where Officer Winkle was waiting without the slightest trace of humor or goodwill. He produced keys by the dozens, somehow found the three that fit the heavy padlocks, and said to me, "Over here," as he opened the gates. I followed him through the gravel lot, avoiding, when possible, the potholes filled with brown water and mud. My entire body ached with every move, so my hopping and dodging were restricted. He went straight to my car. I went right to the front seat. No file. After a moment of panic, I found it, behind the driver's seat on the floor, intact. I grabbed it and was ready to go. I was in no mood to survey the damage I'd walked away from. I had survived in one piece, and that was all that mattered. I'd haggle with the insurance company next week. "Is that it?" Winkle asked. "Yes," I said, ready to bolt. "Follow me." We entered the shed, where a butane heater roared in a corner, blasting us with hot air. He selected one of 10 clipboards from the wall and began staring at the file I was holding. "Brown manila file," he said as he wrote, "about 2 inches thick." I stood there, clutching it as if it were gold. "Is there a name on it?" I was in no position to protest. One smart-ass remark, and they would never find me. "Why do you need it?" I asked. "Put it on the table," he said. On the table it went. "River Oaks / TAG Incorporated," he said, still writing. "File number TBC963381. My trail widened even more. "Do you own this?" he asked, pointing with no small amount of suspicion. "Yes." "Okay. You can go now." I thanked him and got no response. I wanted to jog across the lot, but walking was enough of a challenge. He locked the gates behind me. Mordecai and Peeler both turned around and looked at the file once I was inside. Neither had a clue. I had told Mordecai only that the file was very important. I needed to retrieve it before it was destroyed. All that effort for one plain manila file. I was tempted to flip through it as we drove back to the clinic, but I didn't. I thanked Peeler, said goodbye to Mordecai, and drove, cautiously, to my new loft. The source of the money was the federal government, no surprise in D.C. The Postal Service planned to construct a $20 million bulk mail facility in the city, and River Oaks was one of several aggressive real estate companies hoping to build, lease, and manage it. Several sites had been considered, all in rough and decaying sections of the city. A short list of three had been announced the previous December. River Oaks had begun snapping up all the cheap real estate it might need. TAG was a duly registered corporation whose sole stockholder was Tillman Gantry, described in a file memo as a former pimp, small-time hustler, and twice-convicted felon, one of many such characters in the city. After crime, Gantry had discovered used cars and real estate. He purchased abandoned buildings, sometimes doing quickie renovations and reselling, sometimes offering space for rent. 14 TAG properties were listed in a file summary. Gantry's path crossed that of River Oaks when the U.S. Postal Service needed more space. On January 6, the Postal Service informed River Oaks by registered mail that the company had been chosen to be the contractor, owner, landlord of the new bulk facility. A memorandum of agreement provided for annual rental payments of $1.5 million for a guaranteed period of 20 years. The letter also said, with non-governmental-like haste, that a final agreement between River Oaks and the Postal Service would have to be signed no later than March 1, or the deal was off. After 7 years of contemplating and planning, the feds wanted it built overnight. River Oaks and its lawyers and realtors went to work. In January, the company purchased 4 properties on Florida near the warehouse where the eviction took place. The file had 2 maps of the area, with shaded colors indicating lots purchased and lots under negotiation. March 1 was only 7 days away. Small wonder Chance missed the file so quickly. He was working with it every day. The warehouse on Florida Avenue had been purchased by TAG the previous July for a sum not revealed in the file. River Oaks bought it for $200,000 on January 31, 4 days before the eviction that sent Devon Hardy and the Burton family into the streets. On the bare wooden floor of what would become my living room, I carefully removed each sheet of paper from the file, examined it, then described it in detail on a legal pad so that I could put it back together in perfect order. There was the usual collection of papers I assumed to be in every real estate file, tax records for prior years, a chain of title, previous deeds, an agreement for the purchase and sale of the property, correspondence with the realtor, closing papers. It was a cash deal, so no bank was involved. On the left inside flap of the file was the journal, a pre-printed form used to log each entry by date and brief description. You could judge the organizational capacity of a Drake and Sweeney secretary by the level of detail in a file's journal. Every piece of paper, map, photo, or chart, anything and everything that was punched into a file was supposed to be recorded in the journal. This had been drilled into our heads during boot camp. Most of us had learned the hard way. There was nothing more frustrating than flipping through a thick file in search of something that had not been logged in with sufficient detail. If you can't find it in 30 seconds, the axiom said, it's useless. Chance's file was meticulous. His secretary was a woman of details. But there had been tampering. On January 22, Hector Palma went to the warehouse alone for a routine pre-purchase inspection. As he was entering a designated door, he was mugged by 2 street punks who hit him over the head with a stick of some sort and took his wallet and cash at knife point. He stayed at home on January 23 and prepared a memo to the file describing the assault. The last sentence read, "Will return on Monday, January 27, with guard to inspect." The memo was properly logged into the file. But there was no memo from his second visit. A January 27 entry into the journal said HP memo, site visit, inspection of premises. Hector went to the warehouse on the 27th with a guard, inspected the place, no doubt found that serious squatting was underway, and prepared a memo, which, judging by his other paperwork, was probably quite thorough. The memo had been removed from the file. Certainly no crime, and I had taken things from files all the time without making a note in the journal, but I damn sure put them back. If an item was logged in, it was supposed to be in the file. The closing took place on January 31, a Friday. The following Tuesday, Hector returned to the warehouse to remove the squatters. He was assisted by a guard from a private security firm, a district cop, and 4 roughnecks from an eviction company. It took 3 hours, according to his memo, which ran for 2 pages. Though he tried to mask his emotions, Hector didn't have the stomach for evictions. My heart stopped when I read the following. The mother had 4 children, 1 an infant. She lived in a 2-room apartment with no plumbing. They slept on 2 mattresses on the floor. She fought with the policeman while her children watched. She was eventually removed. So Ontario watched while his mother fought. There was a list of those evicted, 17 in all, with children excluded, the same list someone had placed on my desk Monday morning, with a copy of the Post story. In the back of the file, lying loose without the benefit of a journal entry, were eviction notices for the 17. They had not been used. Squatters have no rights, including the right to be notified. The notices had been prepared as an afterthought, an effort to cover the trail. They had probably been stuck in after the Mister episode by Chance himself, just in case he might need them. The tampering was obvious and foolish. But then Chance was a partner. It was virtually unheard of for a partner to surrender a file. It hadn't been surrendered, it had been stolen. An act of larceny, a crime for which evidence was now being gathered. The thief was an idiot. As part of my pre-employment ritual, 7 years earlier, I had been fingerprinted by private investigators. It would be a simple matter to match those prints with the ones lifted from Chance's file cabinet. It would take only minutes. I was certain it had already been done. Could there be a warrant for my arrest? It was inevitable. Most of the floor was covered when I finished, 3 hours after I started. I carefully reassembled the file, then drove to the clinic and copied it. She was shopping, her note said. We had nice luggage, an item we failed to mention when we split the assets. She would be traveling more than I in the near future, so I took the cheap stuff, duffel and gym bags. I didn't want to get caught, so I threw the basics into a pile on the bed. Socks, underwear, t-shirts, toiletries, shoes, but only the ones I had worn in the past year. She could discard the others. I hurriedly cleaned out my drawers and my side of the medicine cabinet. Wounded and aching, physically and otherwise, I hauled the bags down 2 flights of stairs to my rental car, then went back up for a load of suits and dress clothes. I found my old sleeping bag, unused for at least the last 5 years, and carried it down, along with a quilt and a pillow. I was entitled to my alarm clock, radio, portable CD player with a few CDs, 13-inch color TV on the kitchen counter, 1 coffee pot, hair dryer, and the set of blue towels. When the car was full, I left a note telling her I was gone. I placed it next to the one she'd left and refused to stare at it. My emotions were mixed and just under the skin, and I was not equipped to deal with them. I'd never moved out before. I wasn't sure how it was done. I locked the door and walked down the stairs. I knew I would be back in a couple of days to get the rest of my things. But the trip down felt like the last time. She would read the note, check the drawers and closets to see what I had taken, and when she realized I had indeed moved out, she would sit in the den for a quick tear. Maybe a good cry. But it would be over before long. She would easily move to the next phase. As I drove away, there was no feeling of liberation. It wasn't a thrill to be single again. Claire and I had both lost. Chapter 17. I locked myself inside the office. The clinic was colder Sunday than it had been on Saturday. I wore a heavy sweater, corduroy pants, thermal socks, and I read the paper at my desk with 2 steaming cups of coffee in front of me. The building had a heating system, but I wasn't about to meddle with it. I missed my chair, my leather executive swivel that rocked and reclined and rolled at my command. My new one was a small step above a folding job you'd rent for a wedding. It promised to be uncomfortable on good days. In my pummeled condition at that moment, it was a torture device. The desk was a battered hand-me-down, probably from an abandoned school, square and box-like, with 3 drawers down each side, which actually opened, but not without a struggle. The 2 clients' chairs on the other side were indeed folding types, one black, the other a greenish color I'd never seen before. The walls were plaster, painted decades ago, and allowed to fade into a shade of pale lemon. The plaster was cracked, the spiders had taken over the corners at the ceiling. The only decoration was a framed placard advertising a march for justice on the mall in July of 1988. The floor was ancient oak, the planks rounded at the edges, evidence of heavy use in prior years. It had been swept recently, the broom still standing in a corner with a dustpan. A gentle cue that if I wanted the dirt cleared again, then it was up to me. Oh, how the mighty had fallen! If my dear brother Warner could have seen me sitting there on Sunday, shivering at my sad little desk, staring at the cracks in the plaster, locked in so that my potential clients couldn't mug me, he would have hurled insults so rich and colorful that I would have been compelled to write them down. I couldn't comprehend my parents' reaction. I would be forced to call them soon and deliver the double shock of my changes of address. A loud bang at the door scared the hell out of me. I bolted upright, unsure of what to do. Were the street punks coming after me? Another knock as I moved toward the front, and I could see a figure trying to look through the bars and thick glass of the front door. It was Barry Nuzzo, shivering and anxious to get to safety. I got things unlocked and let him in. "What a slum hole," he began pleasantly, looking around the front room as I relocked the door. "Quaint, isn't it?" I said, reeling from his presence and trying to figure out what it meant. "What a dump!" He was amused by the place. He walked around Sophia's desk, slowly taking off his gloves, afraid to touch anything for fear of starting an avalanche of files. "We keep the overhead low so we can take all the money home," I said. It was an old joke around Drake and Sweeney. The partners were constantly bitching about the overhead, while at the same time most were concerned about redecorating their offices. "So you're here for the money?" he asked, still amused. "Of course." "You've lost your mind." "I found a call." He walked around some more, peeking into the small offices to the side. "Who pays for this operation?" he asked. "A trust."
"A declining trust?"
"Yes, a rapidly declining trust."
"How'd you find it?"
"Mister hung out here. These were his lawyers."
"Good old mister," he said.
He stopped his examination for a moment and stared at a wall.
"Do you think he would have killed us?"
"No. Nobody was listening to him. He was just another homeless guy. He wanted to be heard."
"Did you ever consider jumping him?"
"No, but I thought about grabbing his gun and shooting Rafter."
"I wish you had."
"Maybe next time."
"Got any coffee?"
"Sure. Have a seat." I didn't want Barry to follow me into the kitchen because it left much to be desired. I found a cup, washed it quickly, and filled it with coffee. I invited him into my office.
"Nice," he said, looking around.
"This is where all the long balls are hit," I said proudly. We took positions across the desk, both chairs squeaking and on the verge of collapse.
"Is this what you dreamed about in law school?" he asked.
"I don't remember law school. I've billed too many hours since then." He finally looked at me without a smirk or a smile, and the kidding was set aside. As bad as the thought was, I couldn't help but wonder if Barry was wired. They had sent Hector into the fray with a bug under his shirt. They would do the same with Barry. He wouldn't volunteer, but they could apply the pressure. I was the enemy.
"So you came here searching for Mister?" he said.
"I guess."
"What did you find?"
"Are you playing dumb, Barry? What's happening at the firm? Have you guys circled the wagons? Are you coming after me?"
He weighed this carefully while taking quick sips from his mug. "This coffee is awful," he said, ready to spit.
"At least it's hot."
"I'm sorry about Claire."
"Thanks, but I'd rather not talk about it."
This book is continued on Disc 5.